Have you ever wondered what started all of this? Why this industry is under the watchful eye of government regulation, reporting, record keeping, and auditing? It wasn't always like this. It was somewhat of a lawless arena, like the Old West, where anything goes. Without a doubt, it was the nation's love of the automobile, which began with the newest innovations when Carl Benz developed a three-wheel motor car in 1893, and the Duryea brothers are touted with building, then selling, the first American-made gasoline-powered car in 1896. Ransom E. Olds is not to be forgotten, for he designed the first commercially successful American-made car and contributed largely to the mass production of automobiles by giving us the progressive assembly line. And later in his career, gave us Rio Speedwagon. Yes, this Rio Speedwagon. Henry Ford built his first car, the Quadricycle, in 1896, but didn't find success until the Model T production in 1908, which lasted to the end of 1927 when he introduced the Model A. Ford is remembered as providing affordable cars to every family by incorporating conveyor belts to the assembly line, which saved time and thereby cut manufacturing costs, which was passed on to the buyer. And car manufacturing history goes on forever, a whole other chapter in American history, filling untold volumes of literature. Fuel for those early automobiles was sold in canisters from hardware stores, livery stables, drug stores, grocers, and various other businesses. Fueling vehicles was a dangerous operation in those days, for it was sloppily poured out of containers into vehicles' fuel tanks. And a lot of the time, while the hot engine idled, when automobile factories began churning out more and more new cars, and they started hitting America's byways, there was a definite need for fueling stations and a safer procedure to easily dispense fuel into cars. In the 1860s, Charles Gilbert and John Barker developed a method of converting crude petroleum distillates into a vapor that was used to illuminate homes and buildings in rural areas. In 1870, they formed the Gilbert and Barker Manufacturing Company. It was 1884 when they became the largest retailer of gasoline in the nation, grabbing the attention of Standard Oil, who eventually acquired them. Later, they became the largest producer of oil-burning industrial furnaces, supplying those furnaces to automobile and other manufacturing facilities. By 1910, they designed and manufactured a hand pump that was capable of drawing gasoline from an underground tank. Between 1929 and 1935, they introduced the first electric and computing pumps. They continued growth and expansion into 1966 when they moved their operations to Greensboro, North Carolina, under the name Gilbarco. Calculating gallons pumped into dollars and cents brought about new challenges for the industry. In 1866, the Root Company, a hinge manufacturer, had expanded into making counting devices, which were used in textile plants and census taking. 30 years later, in 1895, Veeder Manufacturing Company developed a device that calculated miles traveled on a bicycle. In 1928, Veeder and Root merged into Veeder-Root Incorporated. They quickly became the largest manufacturer of counting and computing devices in the world. One day, a pump manufacturer appeared in their doorway, liked what he saw, and incorporated Veeder-Root Computing into his product, the gasoline pump. And from there, gasoline pump computing history is written. All during those early years of fuel storage and dispensing, there was no guidelines nor regulations on how a system should be installed, let alone any licensing program for installers. So it was pretty much anything goes. If you knew how to dig a hole, and most holes in those early years were dug by hand, you could install a tank by simply digging a hole and rolling that tank into that hole. There was no magic to screwing pipes together. There was a little technical mystery in how to measure and fit the pipe together, but once that was mastered, anyone could do it. Anyone. And they did. time and time again because there were no regulations or ordinances to prevent them from doing so, nor were there any guidance documents or practices available to assist installers and direct them in the correct way to perform an underground petroleum storage tank installation. API nor PEI were available to them in these early years. National Fire Protection Association was established in 1896 on the 25th anniversary year of the Great Chicago Fire. Yep, that terrible, destructive event that set the town on fire, caused by Catherine O'Leary's cow, kicked over a lantern in the barn and started the blaze that would destroy Chicago. Would the Great Chicago Fire have occurred if there had been codes and recommended practices in place to prevent the shabbily built buildings from being constructed? Those poorly constructed buildings that kindled that disastrous event? Probably not, but that's what NFPA was founded for, to develop codes to prevent disasters from that from ever happening again. American Petroleum Institute was founded in 1919, and since then has developed more than 800 standards in different areas of the petroleum industry. API recommended practice 1615, titled Installation of Underground Petroleum Storage Systems, was first published in June 1961 and served as guidance document to installers on how to properly install underground fuel systems. However, this didn't prohibit anyone from installing a system without following those guidelines because there was still no mandate, so the problem still existed. National Association of Oil Equipment Jobbers was established in 1951 and changed the name in 1966 to what is known to us today as Petroleum Equipment Institute, or PEI, another nationally recognized trade association. PEI is also recognized internationally and publishes numerous recommended practices for installation, repairs, and inspections of fuel systems. About 1986, they published their first recommended practice, RP-100, Recommended Practices for Installation of Underground Liquid Storage Systems. The Love Canal in Niagara Falls, New York, became a dumping ground for a chemical company from 1942 through 1953, causing massive soil and groundwater contamination. It contributed to many health concerns, miscarriages, birth defects, and learning difficulties. As a result, the federal government tapped into the Federal Disaster Assistance Agency funds to assist the city of Niagara, marking the first time in history that the emergency fund was used for anything other than a national disaster. President Jimmy Carter signed the Comprehensive Environmental Response Compensation and Liability Act, CERCLA, into law in 1980, and it became known as the Superfund Act. Love Canal was the first listing. Due to all of these occurrences, including massive air and water pollution reports, and natural habitats being littered with debris, an offshore oil spilling rig spilling millions of gallons, fouling the beaches of California, President Richard Nixon signed into law the Environmental Protection Act on December the 2nd, 1970. Later that very month, on December the 20th, he signed the Occupational Safety and Health Act. The television show 60 Minutes ran a segment in 1983 exposing the problems associated with leaking petroleum underground storage tanks. This short televised topic, which you will see shortly, gripped the nation's interest and brought widespread attention to the UST industry. The 60 Minute show exposed reports of petroleum products finding their way into utility manholes, residential basements, causing soil and groundwater contamination along the way. There was a loud and definitive outcry from across the country. Action was required to stop all of this from happening. Americans had had enough. Congress directed EPA to fix this. EPA's Office of Underground Storage Tanks published technical standards in the Federal Register on September 23, 1988, and they became effective December the 12th, 1988. EPA published MUST for USTs, which was a short, easy read, and caricatures was very thorough in letting owners of USTs know exactly what was required of them in the new laws and when each requirement had to be completed. It also gave states authority to regulate the UST industry for the operational life of the systems, from installation to removal, cradle to grave. In Texas, it was the Texas Water Commission, the TWC. This agency was up and running full force very rapidly, and surprising to many industry pros, they were properly informed and knew what they were doing from the onset. In later years, it was Texas Natural Resource Conservation Commission, TNRCC, and today, Texas Commission on Environmental Quality, TCEQ. Here's Christina.